This is the first tape of an interview with Virginia Hart for the University of Wisconsin Archives Oral History Project. The interview took place on June 5th, 1984.
It's nice if you can talk in a natural voice without having to talk loud.
Go ahead.
Oh, am I on the University of Rochester, where I graduated way back in 1936. So I got from there to my marriage by meeting my husband in summer school in New York City at the Union Theological. They had at Columbia University, they had a summer school course of 6 weeks for the presidents of campus, YMCAs, YWs, whatever they were called in those years. And I was president on my campus at the University of Rochester, and he was president at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. So 3 years after all that, or maybe I forgot, 39, that was 4 years really, we were married. And I had been in social work with the group work, actually, with the YWCA, with girls and teenagers, and then with the factory girls, and got interested in unions and labor unions and their work with unions. So when we moved to Tennessee, where we lived after our marriage in Knoxville, Tennessee, he was with the TVA in the early period, and I worked again for the YWCA with working girls who were employed in the shops. And then got a job as the education director for the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. And that was fascinating because it was through that, this was 1942, 41, 42. And I ran everything from literacy classes of the 3 R's for these 2,000 factory employees, to hobby classes, to bowling and dancing and everything, you name it, for fun, and to union contracts and grievance procedure and how to deal with the boss. And all this, of course, I'm learning at the same time I'm teaching it. And then I came to Wisconsin with them to a summer school. I had never been in Wisconsin. I'd grown up in New York State and married and gone to Tennessee, but I had never been west. This seemed very west to me at that point. Now I don't think it's west at all. But the University of Wisconsin had quite a famous school for trade union people, really, to educate them and train them, and is still called the School for Workers. That's a real old-timey name. I think the school is now over 50 years old, and that was the name given to it originally.
How did you hear about it?
Well, the union I was working for, the IOGWU, the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, which is one of the big international unions, had a week, no, maybe it was 2 weeks, I've forgotten, 2 weeks maybe at that time, two-week-long institute here, and people came from that union from all over the United States, and so we learned about it, and along with sending delegates from my local, I decided I too would attend it, so I brought up about 3 or 4 Southerners from Knoxville to this school. It was very traumatic because there was racial mixture of blacks and whites, and one of the men that came with us was a real redneck, and he would not sit in the classroom near blacks or be housed and with blacks. And so he finally, we worked and worked with him, but he finally went home. I felt a failure in that respect.
Did you come up with any blacks or were?
No, didn't. We didn't bring any blacks in our delegation. Obviously we had some working in the factory, but in this delegation, which was a few elected delegates, you know, to come to the summer school. That started my interest in University of Wisconsin because they found out then that they had this famous labor economics program. John R. Common's tradition, Professor Selig Perlman was the outstanding person then here. So that led me to decide to come here to do my graduate work, because I had gotten this introduction to the campus. When my husband was drafted, which was 1943, I guess, late, 43 or 44. Anyway, in there, I'm a little vague now on years, months, and all those things, but it was right in there. That must have been 44. We decided I might as well start my graduate work before him. We had planned to both do graduate work together. And he already wanted to come to Wisconsin because the famous professor here in political science was John Gauss, G-A-U-S. And Henry admired him, read his books, and wanted to come to study under him, which he did when he got out of the service in 1946.
So you were along here then doing the graduate work while he was in the service?
Well, I was here getting my master's, and then I joined him for about a year, and then we came back in 46. When he finally got to be a second lieutenant, he had enough money for me to come and live where he was in Texas. He, of course, had hoped he would be sent into action, and he wasn't. He was in the infantry training people in Texas.
So after you finished your graduate work then, is that when you started teaching at the school for work?
Yes, mm-hmm. 1946. And they taught there. And Henry was getting his PhD. And we had a wonderful relationship right away with the faculty. I think that the openness and the informality of Madison just came through to me so much. I can remember coming up on the campus that first year when I started my master's degree, and people saying hi and hello. Oh, I didn't know them. They were total strangers, and I wasn't used to people speaking to you whenever you met them on the street or on the campus in such a friendly way. And then I was really in labor economics to get my master's, but I needed some other courses, particularly in government and political science, interested me, so I took them. So before Henry arrived, I had had a couple courses in his future department and gotten to know some of the professors, which was a great asset to me too, starting in as a, you might say, in that role I would be a graduate student's wife. I'm particularly Llewellyn von Kukulin and Bill Ebenstein were people I studied with. Gordon Skilling I knew well. Those were the political scientists who were our friends, and we were seeing, you know, socially as well. Mm-hmm. One advantage was our age. You see, we were not just fresh out of college, and I think maybe that was another reason it was like being accepted as a peer almost. We weren't quite the same age because we'd been out of college, both of us, by that time, 10 years. Mm-hmm. But we weren't just graduating college either and coming to campus as graduate students.
It was a very small department at that point. Do you suppose that's why it was so friendly, or was it a very close department?
Well, it was smaller, maybe, than it is. I guess it's grown over the years. But I just think there's a quality of the Midwest that maybe people who live here all their lives don't appreciate. And that is a kind of openness and friendliness and not putting on airs. People in the East, particularly in New England, are said to be much more formal, mm-hmm. In their socializing and their intermingling.
Yes. Well, I guess back to the School for Social, for Workers, what were your first impressions of that school? That follow through in years later, the kinds of things that you expected?
Yes, it was just great. The thing that Ernest Schwarzstrauber was the director then, and we all had the kind of evangelical fervor, you know, in the work that we were doing, because we believed in unions, we believed in helping give the skills to the union people who were leaders or becoming leaders, and that was the point of the whole School for Workers. When they founded it, they said that in Wisconsin, collective bargaining is recognized, you know, by law. But the employers have skilled people who have already had training. They've gone to college, they're accountants, they're lawyers, they're managers, have had education, and they have already some skill in dealing with labor relations and dealing with labor laws and perhaps in dealing with people too. Well, the unions, the workers who came right out of this factory or the telephone workers or stores or whoever they were, in those days, see, that was still right after the big growth of trade union membership in our country. And they had very little opportunity to get any of those skills themselves unless there was some kind of an organized education program for them. And the philosophy of the School for Workers was, have it for them separate from management. And one way, it gives them more self-confidence. They're in classes, they need to be motivated. They don't get college credit. They don't come if they aren't interested. So it puts a great burden on the teacher to make the teaching relevant to their experience and useful.
How did the students feel when they came to the university? Did they feel on the fringes, or did they feel part of it?
Well, I think that compared to that whole mob of people, this was summertime. Well, you know, in summer school, in the war years, it was small. It wasn't as big as summer school is today. There was still, there were a lot of school teachers that were coming back, you know, in the summer school on the campus and around, but we had our own social identity in the terms of doing things together, because we rented the School for Workers, that is, rented fraternity houses and others there along the lake, which we used for our housing, and then later we moved into the regular dorms out here on the lakeshore dorms and used those where the meals were served, and we didn't have to bother to hire cooks. But we had a kind of socializing faculty and students together and doing things together that was very different from, I think, from nowadays. And maybe it's partly the whole times have changed. We didn't have television. People after class would sit around and do things together. We'd have games and baseball and, you know, volleyball and things like that. We had field trips. We had classes at night, lectures and all that sort of thing. The thrilling thing was really seeing people grow and develop. And these would be adults, men and women, who maybe had pretty humdrum jobs. And getting out of that milieu for a week or 2 weeks, it was itself a bonanza, you know, or a vacation, and to come to this beautiful spot.
In the summer
was another one. And then the third one was all of a sudden beginning to think and to use their powers, you know, and see them grow and develop. Just very exciting.
Did you see a lot of changes in these students as they came over the years?
Yes.
Like, you know,
kind of? Well, for instance, the kind of changes would be in leadership posts. I stayed long enough, off and on through the years, maybe 30 years, at the School for Workers, although I would leave, you know, we had small children, or I'd go to India for a year or two and come back and teach again. I wasn't full-time in that many of those years, or I'd be just full-time in the summertime. But I could see them elected to office. People would write me notes, or I'd meet them and they would say, that class and speaking really gave me self-confidence, and look where I am now. And all kinds of feedback comes from people who have moved into circles, you know, of responsibility in their own organizations, whatever they were, unions, and they were on the local level. Some of them I know went to the state leadership level, and some also to the national, and I'm sure that the educational opportunities that they had here in Wisconsin had something to do with it. But you know, the individual has to be a really caring person who is working and developing himself or herself.
Mm-hmm. How was this received by the university community as a whole?
Well, it was looked on at first as being kind of radical. And there were some people who challenged it as being teaching people to strike.
Was it ever looked upon as being a little bit too socialistic or
communistic? Yeah, the old communist, that could be a word that one man used. His name was Vern Kaub, K-A-U-B, you may. People would remember him from the newspapers. I had my master's thesis was a book, a little booklet called Union Community Relations. And Mr. Perlman, Professor Perlman, said it would be fine to write something that could be used in this program, in this workers' education program. And I also helped assist another person later named Hi Kornbluh, who is on the faculty, heads up the University of Michigan labor education program. He did a booklet on the workers' compensation laws in Wisconsin, written in a way that's readable and interesting to workers, sort of handbook type of thing. So I remember the charge was made by some very conservative people at that time that this looked like it was very radical, telling people to get so active in their unions and get into the politics and get into community activities in the school and everywhere, you know. I think what we were saying is don't think of yourself as being on the wrong side of the tracks. You're a part of the community, and as a worker you should be in your union too. You should be active in everything that's going on.
Now, was this when Fred was president yet or not?
When I first came, Dykstra was president, and then somebody, I believe, was before President Fred. I'm trying to think who that was. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. But they were supportive.
Oh, yes, the administration was. And Nate Feinsinger, Nathan Feinsinger, nationally known, you know, labor expert in the law school, was active in our committee. So was Elizabeth Brandeis, Rauschenbusch, who just recently died. Adolfson was the director of Extension, and I've talked with him in the last year or two. He's retired too. We finally were put under Extension. We used to report right to the president's office. There was no tie with Extension. Mm-hmm. And then in the hierarchy, I think maybe when Ed Young, who was the president for a while of the university, mm-hmm. acted as director of the School for Workers for a year or so in a position, in a period when we lost one director and were hiring a new one, and he took it for a year. He was a professor of labor economics, you know. And I think that the university community, many of the people, were always very supportive, and they were an advisory council to the school and the way things were done, and they have been all through the years. Made up also of labor people, labor leadership in the state. Wisconsin has been quite famous in Milwaukee, particularly of having unusual leadership. In fact, Jake Friedrich, the president of the Board of Regents, was a machinist union member who was, president of the Regents maybe for 5 or 10 years. Came from this tradition of the German socialists, you might say, in Milwaukee, who cared a lot about education, and they are the ones that pushed and they wanted to have courses taught for their workers.
How did industry in Wisconsin feel about this?
Well, industry had reservations very early on. And I can remember our job was to teach out in the state in different cities in the wintertime. Summer people came here, and we had a resident summer school 1 week at a time. Used to be 2 weeks, then we cut them down to 1 week, and we'd go on for the whole summer. auto workers would come for a week and the telephone workers for a week and so forth. Sometimes we would have steel workers for a week. Sometimes we'd have two different ones at the same time. And in the winter, the program was to go to their town or city and teach a course like every Thursday night for 8 weeks. And that was worked out through the vocational school system. And that got good community support because the vocational school system, of course, had both labor and management advisory people on their boards. They were giving the course to union people, but they wouldn't close it to management or somebody else if they wanted to come to it. I remember when the Taft-Hartley law was passed in 1947, I was teaching in Wisconsin Rapids, and the president of the League of Women Voters came to the class because she was interested in knowing about that new law. And also there was a man from management who came to it. But typically it was really the workers who came, just the union people, to these classes. And if you didn't make it interesting or worth their while, they just didn't come.
Was there any opposition by any industry to what you were doing there?
Oh, I'm sure there was through the years. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there was off and on. But I think that we have an enlightened group of employers and manufacturers and others who have worked closely with the School for Workers for many, many years now. And so that hurdle was gone over years and years ago. So that no longer exists.
Were there any problems like in the 50s, during the McCarthy era, or through the 60s and the protest movement that affected the program?
I really don't know. I can't recall about any impact that would be different on them, you know, from the whole university. I guess I don't. The women's, if you want me to talk about the encroachment of the women's movement.
Well, I was thinking that. This sounds like very much of a man's world in many respects.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm wondering how you felt about it and how you were accepted in your role.
Well, it's a funny thing. When you're probably the only woman on the faculty and the staff, it's both an advantage and a disadvantage, because it's a little different to take a class from a woman, because at least it's a different kind of person up there talking to you and teaching you. And so I think maybe in the years it helped me in some ways. Of course, I wasn't one of the boys in terms of a lot of the stuff they did together, you know. And yet we had a wonderful kind of social activity of being together, the faculty and the students, and so there was a wonderfully genuine acceptance of me as a woman and others who came later. The women's movement is interesting because gradually there were more women coming to the school. Ordinarily there would just be a very few, be mostly a male group, unless you, for example, had an industry like the garment workers where they were mostly women, mm-hmm. and very few men, because the women who were in the needle trades and sewing and making clothing, you know, were on the whole women, not men. Men were the cutters and had some of the very highly skilled jobs, or the machinists who were fixing the machinery. But through the years, we began to, I myself, of course, began to get this women's consciousness in terms of helping develop more leadership, acceptance of women. And as late, it wasn't until 1970 that I had the first class just for women in Milwaukee. And it was to train them to be union leaders. And I worked with the state AFL-CIO. We had statewide conferences, and I, as a staff member from the School for Workers, helped a lot with putting those on to encourage women from all different occupations to come to the conferences and learn about the laws that protected them learn how to have the courage to talk to your boss and to get active and go to union meetings, because you can't be a leader if you're not willing to participate. Mm-hmm. And so we had already, before that time, I had invited women. Well, Kate Clarenbach is a very good example. Catherine Conroy is another one, if you happen to know her name. She retired recently as a CWA, Communication Workers Union staff director. She's a most unusual woman. Well, people like that I knew, and Catherine was already coming with her union to teach, but she talked at my retirement party, for example, about the fact that I had an impact on her and other women by the fact that I was a woman doing what I was doing, teaching and working with union people in that educational scene. So things have changed. They really have changed a lot, and it's quite exciting to see this awareness.
Right. Were you very aware of women's limitations or the attitudes that women had when you first started working?
Women in the factory or women of my education?
Women in your education and generation when you came to the university, that they were not as involved?
I guess not. I think I'm one of those people who grew up thinking I could do it. I did it, and I was active, and I got into all kinds of causes and, you know, working to help the plight of poor people or discrimination, fight discrimination against minorities. And so in politics, I got into that. So I guess I never felt like I was really put upon as a person, but I also knew that women, many women were very timid and didn't have maybe the self-confidence to go ahead and do their thing.
Why do you think you had that self-confidence? Did you always have it as a kid?
This is really funny. I've just spent a month with my twin sister, my identical twin sister. Here we are, going to be 70 next month. And we still are identical, and almost identical in looks. But she was telling me how I was more aggressive than she. And I think she's probably right. Through the years, I've been the career woman and she has been the housewife, not in as much activity or even, although when we were in college, she was president of student government and I was president of the Y, and we were president, vice president, freshman class, so we were always active, you know, mm-hmm. stuff like that.
But your goals were different.
I guess so. My big confession is that I didn't have a goal to do this or that, and when I talk to young people now and I realize that we're saying to our own children, and we have been, you know, what are your goals? Well, I didn't have any long-range plan, or I just went from one interesting thing to another.
But and you had a set of principles, apparently, that you believed in. That's what I'm hearing.
I guess
that's
so. I enjoyed working with people and fighting against injustices I saw.
Did you get this from your parents?
Organizing, no. My mother was a nurse, and my father was in real estate, and very conservative Republicans who never knew they had anybody in the family who would be interested in unions or be a Democrat. But that is strange when you ask that. The thing that I see sometimes now with the women's movement, well, the School for Workers is a very good illustration. They hired a young woman attorney on their staff just a few years ago, and she's been doing a lot of teaching to women about women and about their rights and fair employment laws and discrimination. And so there's much more, and I was doing courses like that, and so were some of the men on the staff for the last 15, 20 years, just saying this is what the law is, you shouldn't discriminate. And but there's kind of a new focus and sensitivity to it, I think, with the women from the women's movement, and I would call her as representative of the women's movement now, and identifying with that, which I find really thrilling. It's, to me, it makes me feel more ageless in the sense that I think a lot of us women of my age who are working, were working, you know, a long, long time ago, and we didn't have a kind of women's movement as we do today, but we had people, there were outstanding women working with trade unions very early on. Outstanding women who, like myself, were college educated, came from homes where there hadn't been an association with trade unions, you know, or factory workers or strikes or anything like that, but it was sort of the opportunity, I guess, for people, say in the saying, I want to join in this struggle to help sort of balance things in our society. And so people were doing it through the trade union movement. And it's perhaps a, I saw it also in politics, in people working through a party to do that same thing politically. This is really curious because I can jump from the union to the party for a few years because my husband got tired of my traveling all the time and being gone every night while he was getting his PhD, so he asked if I wouldn't stay home and stop teaching for a while and maybe help him. Well, to reveal how unhelpful I was in his research for his PhD, he'd send me to the library with certain things to look up and assist him in this, and I was really no good at it at all, and it was a strain on our relationship. And finally, and I was typing some for him, and I'm a terrible typist, and this is on his PhD thesis, so finally I talked him into letting me take a job conducting a housing survey for the Madison Housing Authority, and then it got started in being a volunteer in politics with the Democratic Party, which I'd never joined before, and I thought, this is a great opportunity. And a year or two later, I ended up being their first executive secretary for the state party. And this was really exciting because we were at the point of just developing a whole political party wide open. It wasn't like Illinois or New Jersey or somewhere else where everything's tight shut and you never could come in as a younger, new person and take a leadership role. And the people that we know now, Jim Doyle, who is the judge, was the state chairman. I was the executive director. Carl Thompson, who was just retiring from the state legislature as the state senator through the years, was running for governor. Gaylord Nelson, who's now retired as senator, was in the state senate, and so on. So I had an opportunity to help in this organizing and getting volunteers. I think all my life I've been getting other people to work and do things, and maybe that was my talent. I'm not saying that I'm particularly good at writing, and I know I'm not writing issue papers or doing research, but I think probably my talent has been in working with people. And so what that meant in organizing the state party headquarters was getting a lot of people involved in doing things, and the Madison headquarters was right downtown, you know, and we had people from everywhere doing all kinds of volunteer work. And that was a very interesting link with the university because our closest friends today of 40 years now are people that we all work together in politics, and they're still here in the faculty or judges or other people, you know, in town doing things. We've been together all these years. And we were doing things together in the political scene.
back then, 40 years ago, it gave me, I was thinking about that in relation to the faculty. I guess it gave me a new way of, a marvelous way of meeting hundreds of people. See, I never had the handicap, I guess it is, of a new faculty wife having to meet and make friends and find her way in a community.
Because you never joined those organizations?
No, I didn't feel I needed to, because I had been here a few years and I knew so many people. I went to newcomers, or whatever they had, I think that's what it was called, University League or something, once in a while, but I never joined because I was so busy doing all these other things, and I think they have marvelous activities which help people meet each other. But, you see, my husband had finished his graduate work and been asked to join the faculty, which is very rare. Usually, somebody has to get his PhD, go away, teach somewhere else, and then be hired back on campus again here. But Henry was older, and he did an outstanding job, and they asked him to join the faculty, so he did. He became a political science, assistant professor first, and then later on up the line to a full professor and a tenure. So we had this faculty relationship, but I already had all these acquaintances in town through politics, for one thing, which included faculty along with the other people in the community, too.
Did you do a lot of entertaining of faculty in connection with the department?
We did some, but that's a nice thing, I think, about our department. Our department, meaning Henry's department. There wasn't a kind of forced social life. I know in some departments to this day there is a kind of unwritten social life pressure of people to do things together and to be convivial and so forth. That didn't happen in the political science department, which was very refreshing. When Henry was a graduate student, I mentioned John Goss and his wife Jane. They had a tradition, I think it was on Saturday afternoons, if I can recall, of an open house, and they lived up on Vilas Circle. And I can remember going there, and it was such a treat. You could just go once you were sort of generally invited as a graduate student and take your wife and sit around and have tea and talk and with him and his wife, and it was just a very lovely thing to do.
How often did they do this?
I think they may have done it once or twice a month. And I can remember now still sitting there outdoors on the porch they had and meeting people, other people that way too. Other faculty had, the other faculty in the political science department entertained us as graduate students. There was a real warmth within the department for us, you know, as graduate students. And then when we became faculty, I mean, we always do a lot of entertaining and back and forth with people, but it didn't have to be just our department. In fact, our friends were, you know, scattered around throughout the university and in the community too. People were not just right off the faculty. I know one thing that can exert pressure, and I think this may happen from what I understand. Faculty wives might have a little pressure to socialize together. And it only occurred in the history of my experience in the political science department, one period when there was one chairman's wife who had organized a luncheon and thought there should be a little more organization to having us as wives meet with each other. But that died out.
Was Henry a chairman at one point, wasn't he?
Not of the political science. He was chairman in Indian studies. It's called, I guess, Asian studies now, Southeast Asian studies. He helped form that department. And then he's been chairman over in environmental studies in recent time before he retired. But he was never the chairman of political science.
Did that have any effect on your social relationships or at all?
I can't see that.
I was wondering when you were talking about the fact that he wanted you to help him
and quit your job. Did this, did he finally come to realize that maybe this wasn't your thing? And
oh, I'm sure he did very, very early. Very early on.
And did he at any other time encourage you or pressure you to not do something in connection with your work? Or,
no.
Or
no.
Did you feel pretty free to?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I couldn't, all through these years, I couldn't have had jobs where I've had to work so much nights, weekends, travel, be away from home, and do things that he really believed in just as much as I did. So it was very much of a joint effort, you know, in terms of his belief in it. Then when we adopted children, we had no children. We've been married 11 years, and we wanted children very badly. And when we knew we would stay in Wisconsin, then we applied here because we thought after Henry finished, we might go somewhere else, you know, where he would be getting a job. But when he got one here, we could apply here, and we got our first child in 1950, and our daughter, and our son 4 years later in 1954. So, but in between, we went to India for 2 years. So we started our work, Henry's work in India. Went in 52 to 54, came home for 4 years, went back 58 and 9, came home for 4 years, went back in 63 and 64, and then came home. And I didn't, children have not been back, grown up now. But I went back last summer after 19 years for the first time when we went to trek in the Himalayas all summer, last summer. But the Henry has kept going. He's been working on India, writing, going to meetings there. So he's had maybe a year there or half a year there or a summer and different times. So his connection has been very close while it has not been that much with the rest of us since that time.
Did you find that this interrupted the work that you were doing here, or was that no problem when you left to go?
It was a no problem in because I was doing part-time work. Mm-hmm. And I got in, I was very active in community welfare work. At one period when the children were young, Gordon Senekin, an attorney in town, a wonderful person, got me talked into serving on the Community Welfare Council, which was the planning counterpart of the Community Chest. This is before they changed the name to United Way. And so I became the first woman to ever be president of that. And again, it was a marvelous way to learn about the community and to do organizational planning and work for social needs in Madison. And also get to know the power structure and different people, because obviously on those boards and committees, and I was on the Community Chest, or which would be the United Way now, the presidents of CUNA and Oscar Mayer and Ischold and other people were serving, and the banks. And so I have a kind of base of operation in those years of knowing a great variety of people, which was very helpful in any kind of work that I was doing, organizational work or community work, and very rewarding, really. That was when I first got to know Mary Louise Simon. She was in the League of Women Voters, very active in League of Women Voters, and I was president, and we both knew about all these different things that were happening, and I remember we were
this
going to...
This was back when?
That would be in about 66, somewhere in there, in the late, in the 60s. And Mary Louise, I had been on the mayor's Council on Human Rights, it was called at that time, and she came on that, and Frances Hurst preceded me, then she left it, and I came on, probably at her suggestion, then Mary Louise Simon came on when I left it, probably at my suggestion. We had women whom you probably know, you know, who were involved back in those years in different fronts. And then Mary Louise was the leader of the Fair Employment
Practices Commission here locally, and led that for many years. She carried on in that, and then she got into the county board and, you know, became the chairman and very much of a leader in the country. But I think I got a little bit off the line there.
Well, we were talking a little bit about India, and I was wondering how your children, was it any problem having the children leave Madison and come back?
Yeah, I think it was. At first, our daughter was only 2 to 4, and so it didn't matter. She wasn't in school at all, and she loved riding the elephant and doing these interesting things. But as they got to be school age, it was a little more disruptive, I think. Being pulled out of your peer group and then being gone a year and coming back and you don't have your friends all established again. I think that was a little difficult for them. People used to say, oh, aren't you lucky? You've been around the world twice and you've seen some. We used to visit 2 weeks. We couldn't afford longer than that, and we couldn't probably stand each other and the children traveling more than 2 weeks in Europe on the way home, or, you know, in Asia on the way over, in Hong Kong or Japan. And so they got to see some of these places. In fact, I have a funny story about our daughter at 4 when we came home from living 2 years in India. We went out one night and had a babysitter, one of the nurse students, and when we came home she said, I've got to tell you what Nancy said. She said, Nancy is a great talker. She was the kind of child who would stop the policeman and say on the street corner, did you know I rode an elephant in India? And he'd look at her and think, what's with this kid?
You'd highly imaginative.
Yes. She just loved telling everybody everything. So she had been telling, I guess, about some of her travels to the babysitter that night, and so the babysitter said, Nancy, you don't know how lucky you are. She said, look where you've been and look at me. She said, why, I haven't been anywhere but Canada. Nancy looked at her and she said, Canada? Where's that? We've told that story for years.
Well, how do they feel about it now that they're older?
Well, I think they're, you know, they have an identification with the culture and would like to go back and see it. And Nancy's 34, and Ben, our son, is just going to be 30. So it's quite a ways back. Of course, the last time we lived there, Nancy was 13 and Ben was 9. So they haven't seen it, you know, since that period in their lives.
13 would be a hard time, I would imagine.
In a way, it really was.
But you found work there also.
Yes, I did. Uh-huh. I didn't at first work. I went to college and took courses without for credit. Rode a bicycle with my sari on and tried to be like the Indian girls. They had a big, good fun, you know, showing me how to dress and helping me. And it was better. I know how they feel here. Many of the foreign students, they dress in jeans and they try to look like everybody else because you're less conspicuous if you dress the way the other people do than if you're in your own clothing. You have your own culture. But I had a nice job the last time we lived in India in 63. I worked for AID, which is the Agency for International Development, and I was able to use my work with trade unions there because they were starting a program in which the government had already started it, and they ran resident schools for workers, factory workers or bank workers or others. And they were teaching them to become teachers in their own factories when they went back home after a month or two. And my project was to work with the teachers in the way they taught. And so they were used to lecturing, standing up front and just doing it like they'd learned in college themselves, these teachers who were teaching the workers. And I developed materials and showed them the way we used very informal methods of teaching, you know, with quizzes and discussion and films and true-false and taking. I would take their law, for example, in workers' compensation and devise questions about it and try to break it down into something that's a little bit more informal. That was very rewarding. I enjoyed doing that.
Did you have any cultural shock when you came back?
Oh, yes. Yes, this country seemed so wealthy. So wealthy and so many material goods. I remember the first time I came back after 2 years in India, the first time we stayed 2 years, I was in Milwaukee, maybe in Boston store, or Gimbel's, big store, and I just almost overwhelmed when I looked at those racks and racks of clothes, thinking, my gosh, these people that I've been seeing in India, I mean on the whole, are lucky if they have one sari or one change of clothing. And here I am buying something which I don't need, but I want a different color or I want it to be in style. And I have some clothes already at home that I could wear. And it's just the values and the difference in our standard of living is so great.
What about plugging into people and into your social life again when you came back? Is that difficult?
No. For us, you mean as adults?
Mm-hmm.
No. We have never had any problem with that. I was talking to my sister who moved to Florida from Rochester, New York after many, many years, and then they went down there about early on. They took very early retirement. I think they've been there 13 years or 12. And they had to make friends and make us contacts, and I said, well, we really haven't been through that because we've been in Madison, you know, 30, 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And Madison, to me, is just such a marvelous community. There's more people than you have time to be friends with, literally.
Right.
Do you feel that too?
Yes, yes, it's frustrating.
Really?
Uh-huh.
And I think a lot of people don't understand that at all because their contacts are such that they just don't meet that many people. Maybe they, I don't know what, they live maybe in remote places or they have to travel too far or they don't associate through other types of activities.
Mm-hmm.
I can't.
Well now, wasn't it in the 60s where the political science department grew quite a bit, got a lot larger? And were there some political differences within the department then?
I don't know much. I can't remember when the department grew. I know we've always had some fascinating people on the faculty. There are always some that you're closer to than others,
mm-hmm.
naturally,
mm-hmm.
in terms of friendship.
Mm-hmm.
We lived across the street. I remember at the period when we adopted our children in the early 50s, from Jim McCamey and Julia McCamey, and he was in the political science department, and they had obstreperous boys at that period, and I remember they were saying to us, are you sure you really want to adopt children? And we had such a nice, friendly relationship. I remember Jim had finished a book, I don't know which one it was, but anyway, he said, could I store the manuscript, a copy of the manuscript of this book in your attic? Sure, sure, you know, so that went up in the attic. And it was just, of course, it might be just as easily burned up in our house as his house, but I think there was a feeling that, well, I'm going to put a copy of this book in another place than my own house, so it'll be there if anything happens.
Did you know Art Rani?
Yes. Not Art Rani. Oh, what's his first name? I know him. Well, I'll think of it in a minute. It doesn't matter, but we know him.
Is he quite well liked in the department?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
There was a lot of disappointment when we left, I understand.
I think so, too. And, of course, there's divorces happen in the department as they do now in the university, and there are always disappointments and things, you know, in terms of that relationship when people see marriages breaking up.
That was the reason for his leaving.
Well, in a sense, I'm not sure if you could say that was the reason. He took a job in Washington. And I don't know which, I can't tell which came first. But the woman who had been working for him here and with him here was another, a younger faculty wife in the political science department. And she went to Washington, and then he went to Washington, and then we heard about the divorce. But I think political science, I don't know, it's just been a great department. My husband has enjoyed it so much. And the people have been so interesting. And good friends to know and do things with, some we know better than others, of course, just a variety of people. I really feel that it's a different department from some of the others in terms of not having backbiting and feuds and animosity.
Yeah, but I sense in talking to you that there didn't seem to be a lot of political activity going on within the department.
They had a wonderful way of resolving things, and the way they managed the chairmanship and getting sort of consensus, whoever's been the chairman, and Henry's told me how they talk before their staff meetings, and they sound out people about how they feel, and they try to work out kind of a resolution of differences. It may be some different now because there are many younger people, and there maybe some people have a political agenda. I'm really not in a position to comment on that, but just from my outsider's view.
Is he still on the staff? Or?
He's emeritus, and he does things, not regularly, but for example, he just went to Cornell University to be on a conference faculty on water resources. He's very much involved and has been in recent years on planning and use of water and irrigation in India, and particularly written on it for India and Southeast Asia. Well, I went to work, let's see, I went to state government from the School for Workers in 1973. So that changed a whole relationship too.
That was when you were on the...
When I was appointed Secretary of the Department of Regulation and Licensing by Governor Lucy.
In what way did the relationship, with the department or...
Well, it was really fun because here were these professors and people that I knew socially and as friends and colleagues of my husband's, but all of a sudden I was in a seat of some power in terms of being a cabinet member, and it was fun to meet with them and talk with them about linkages in terms of, for example, the whole regulation process, which is very much on the minds and hearts of some of the faculty there, even now, who are concerned, you know, about governmental regulation and licensing and all that. And the same when I, 2 years later, when I went to Diller to head the Industry and Labor Department, because then all my labor friends, and this was really my old field, in the Economics Department or the School for Workers or in the labor movement, but particularly in the context, as we're saying now, of the university, we also had a wonderful linkage and chance to talk back and forth, and I could draw upon some of their expertise to serve on advisory councils and committees, and just had a very, I think it was very helpful to me in my job that I was a faculty wife, known to these people. I had a career, they knew me through the years as a person, you know, who was a professional person, but I also could ask for their help and consult with them and work together. It's really a great, it was a great boon, because the whole philosophy, you know, of Wisconsin idea is that linkage between government and the university and the business community. And so here I was, it was just like almost a dream I could never have imagined. Here I was in a position where this was actually carried on from that early period I'd read about, when all this legislation was first written, like in 1934, the first unemployment compensation legislation was written and drafted, and by people at the university and others. And here I was in responsible in that department, you know, for that law, for the administration of that.
It came a long way. I mean, did you have that feeling of of real accomplishment?
Well, I felt like I didn't ever know enough, ever. But I also was thrilled that I was in a position related to my past in terms of the whole labor field. And I was also thrilled to be the first woman in the cabinet. It didn't bother me as a token, if you might say, that you're going to have a first woman sometime.
Well, you were the first woman on a lot of things.
Yeah, I was. I guess when you come to think of the Welfare Council and where else, I don't know.
On the Judicial Commission, were you the first woman there? The first woman as vice chairman?
I don't know. No, I think there must have been another woman on there, but I can't. When I was on the original one, then they reformed it, and then Fran Hurst came on when I left, and they had a new one which was directly under the Supreme Court. I really can't.
Did you feel a little pressure because you were the first woman on these things?
Oh, yes, I did. Definitely, particularly in government, because I thought I knew something about government and the legislature, and I would take trade union classes to see the legislature in action and all that. My goodness, it was really different when I was responsible myself for running an agency. For example, 2 weeks after I was appointed and took office to head this rather small department, regulation and licensing, you know, licensing maybe 18, 19 boards like the doctors, the medical board, and the nursing board, and the optometrists, and the accountants, and the psychology, and all those.
But you had a large staff, too.
We had a staff of office. I had to appear and defend the agency budget before the Joint Finance Committee, and once you're in state government, the Joint Finance Committee is the like the test of fire, whatever you call it. And so I had a wonderful budget officer who briefed me and worked with me and educated me, and I said, now John, sit beside me, but don't talk, because I have to give the impression that I know what I'm doing, and particularly because I'm the first woman, and they were curious to see how I would handle it. Well, Dennis Conta was co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee from Milwaukee, whom I knew, and with Senator Walter Hollander, who was a very revered, wonderful legislator, who was then, I think, about 75, maybe, or he'd been there many years, and just a wonderful man. He's Republican, and Dennis is a Democrat. And I really got through that quite well, I guess. I mean, the press was watching and sitting there to see if there were any big flounderings, and probably I was given an easier time than maybe I would have been if I hadn't been a woman. I'm really not sure, but I remember one thing that I have always appreciated, and that was that the next day I got a note in the mail from Dennis Conta as co-chair of the Senate, of the Joint Finance Committee of the legislature, congratulating me on my appearance and that whole budget thing. So that got me started in a very nice way, giving me confidence. But when I was running that Department of Regulation and Licensing, it was a wonderful experience. It was a very growing experience for me. When the governor asked me, I turned it down the first time. My husband said, oh, that will be tough. Nobody wants to work with you. The doctors don't want you to interfere with them, you know, and the psychologists and the real estate people. Nobody will want you to mess around with them. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, what an opportunity. Here I am, 58 years old, and at the I love teaching. I love doing what I'm doing. I'd just soon stay teaching unions until I'm quitting, you know, retiring. But here's an opportunity to do a whole new thing in government. And so I talked him into it, saying, yes, I'm going to do this now. And I'm really glad I did. I had no idea that the 10 years would be so full of excitement and growth and horror. I had some horror stories, really horror stories, because of the problems I had when I moved over to Dillard. That
you want to tell any horror stories?
Oh, yes, I don't mind telling those. Well, one of the early experiences I had, for example, the 2 years I was heading regulation and licensing were like an apprenticeship, because that was a small department. I learned the ropes. I learned how you have to deal with a budget, how you hire people, the whole civil service process. And I had these licensing boards that weren't used at all to having the secretary of the department come and sit in when they have their meetings. And so I would go and stay 8 hours, or however long their meetings lasted. And I remember one man from chiropractic board turning to me after 2 or 3 hours and saying, well, have you heard enough now, Mrs. Hart? You can go now. And I said, oh, thanks very much. I said, I'm very interested. No, I'm not in a hurry to leave at all. And I stayed. And I learned a lot because of their interaction and the way they dealt with their fellow licensees. And I learned that what they needed was some training and education in the law. They weren't even following the law in terms of their hearing procedure. So I was able to start a lot of professional ways of doing things through help from the Attorney General's office. And we had a training them on administrative rulemaking. I had a workshop every year for a couple of days out, and we went to the Dells or somewhere like that, and we mixed them all together. Can you imagine the doctors and their wives and the chiropractors at the same meeting, and we square dance together? You know, I used my old group work skills and getting things started like that, where they learned that you have to have a process and there is a governmental standard of how you work, you know, within this agency. Mm-hmm. Well, the man who had the job before me showed up for work, sat around, read the paper, smoked a cigar for maybe half a day, then he went to the tavern. So they were not accustomed at all to having a professional woman in there as a secretary who was going to work and see that they worked and look into how everything was done. So that was, I really enjoyed it. And I think the people and the department and the people with whom I worked did too. I just had wonderful feedback when I left that we had moved along, and then the next secretary that came, you know, was able to make some other changes and move along. But the horror stories were the next job when I shifted over, and that was 73 to 75, and 75 to 77, Governor Lucy named me chairman of Diller, Department of Industry, Labor, and Human Relations, and there's three commissioners. And one of them he names as the chairman of the commission and the department. Well, the other two commissioners were men whom I had known. One of them I'd known quite a long time, union men. Both were union men. One was out of the legislature, and the other was state county municipal workers. And they really gave me a hard time for 2 years. We had all kinds of controversy in the newspaper because they had the feeling that we were all going to run the department, and you can't run anything. This was now going to a department. Instead of 80 employees, we had 2,800 employees, and you can imagine the problems that we were confronting. And it was exciting and challenging and the toughest job I ever had in my life. I think I worked 60-hour weeks at least, week after week, and had my name dragged out in the papers and these terrible things said about me by these men.
You?
It bother me some, particularly when they would get the legislative committee to have a hearing and then, you know, criticize me. And it was just, I think it was based on two things. The men, I never would say this during those years, but I think they didn't like a woman being put in charge and being the chair, which Governor Lucy had named me as. And they didn't also like having the administrative running of the department go through one person. And that was what the governor had directed me to do. And we had a study, and we had the Attorney General's opinion, yes, that that was the proper way. We kept asking for Attorney General's opinions to see that was the proper way for it to be done. So my name was dragged around quite a bit. Then when the reorganization came, Pat Lucy went to Mexico as ambassador. Schreiber became acting governor. And there was a reorganization, and I think it was because of that inability of a three-member commission to run the department because of the way these other two conducted themselves that they then said, let's have a secretary, we'll do away with the three commissioners, and we'll move the three commissioners into another agency, which is called a review agency. It's a review board. And so the three of us then became full-time review board members just on cases of appeal on unemployment compensation or workers' compensation or equal rights discrimination cases. And that was fascinating and very quiet. I mean, here we were day after day doing very interesting but very quiet work with a staff of 28. And again, I was chairman and the administrator head in terms of relating and working with staff, and so that's what I did for the next period, 4 years.
Over the years, did you see a change as you worked and you were in charge? Did you see the change in the attitudes of men in accepting women in these positions?
I see it more now than I did then. I know from things that people said to me at that period. There was one, for example, who was the head of the buildings and safety. He was an engineer. He could not accept me, and I criticized his job performance and didn't give him a merit increase because he didn't deserve it. And he found it very difficult to take from a woman. And I think that now women have, we have three secretaries of different departments now, three women in high positions. Linda Rivets, the biggest Department of Health and Social Services, Doris Hansen in Department of Administration, and my old Department of Regulation and Licensing, Barbara Nichols, heads. So there, and there are many other women who are deputy secretaries and who are in positions of authority. So I think that just in state government alone, but this is true elsewhere, people are much more accustomed to women having some position of power and authority. I think that's changed a lot. I see the growth and the development of these young women as being the most wonderful thing. I think probably the greatest fringe benefit I had in state government, maybe it was working with these younger women. Just, they're so smart. They're so sharp. And we're all, you know, sisters together. I was the oldest and I'd been there first, but I learn from them all the time, and they'll call me their role model, but deep down in my heart, I know they're smarter than I am. On my heart, I mean, I know they've got so much on the ball. So it's just a marvelous
But you've
thing.
Gone where they haven't yet.
Well, I've gone right out into retirement, yeah.
Well, are you really going to retire now, or
Well,
do you have some other things that you would like to do?
Well, I'm on two boards, you know. I'm on the State Public Defender Board, which is a nine-member board. Tony Earle, Governor Earle, appointed me to that just as I retired, and he wanted a whole reorganization of that board, which he got. He appointed the membership, and we've been working very hard. I spent the morning downtown working on a project with them. So I spend some time on, it's a monthly board meeting, but I spend some time in between on that, and I learned a lot. And again, it's a challenge to, I didn't really understand the public defender system,
and I've learned a lot, so it's rewarding. And I also, because I'm an insider in state government and nobody else on the board has come from running an agency, I have a better understanding and sensitivity to the problems we have internally in the agency and running it, and work with staff on, from that point of view. And I'm on the Madison Police and Fire Commission. I've already been 4 years on that, and I have a year left. It's a 5-year term, and I enjoy that very much. It's so related. You see, I was doing discrimination cases and equal rights, and I had the responsibility earlier in Diller for the whole equal rights thing, and so we're like a personnel committee. We hear the complaints and the grievances. If the police or the fire department people decide that they want to go the route of taking it for a hearing before us instead of going through their grievance procedure, they can take a choice themselves which way to take it. But we also hire the chiefs. So we don't run it. The chiefs report to the mayor. But we hire the chiefs, and we approve of all promotions and other personnel changes that the chiefs bring before us and wish to make. So it's really an interesting responsibility, and I've enjoyed that. So I have, you know, that sort of thing doing, and my husband is now working in a political campaign for the legislature. Becky Young, a political science professor's wife, who's a good friend and has been active, as we all, you know, in the county board and the school board, and she was a deputy secretary in state government. She's done a lot. Well, now he's working on her campaign, and I'm helping with that. And we get into a lot of different things.
Well, I have a feeling with your background and experience, it will be hard to retire.
Well, I guess I'm goofing off all the time. Here we go traveling, you know. We're going to Peru for 6 weeks this summer and climb and hike around in Peru and Bolivia. Last summer we went to India and did that in the Himalayas for 10 weeks. Basically
these are vacations.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. A vacation from a vacation, as I say. I feel guilty when I talk to all these people who are still working and are so tired. One of the staff people said to me today, "Do you look rested?" And I said, "Well, I should be. I'm on vacation."
Well, all this while I've been wondering, you know, your interest and your experience in labor management. And I think a lot of women would want the answer to this question, how you manage the home front.
Well, that's a good question.
All your activities.
Well, my husband, of course, as I said earlier, has always been a partner in terms of believing in what I was doing and being very tolerant of my hours. Because when I worked in the YW, and I worked with unions, they're always working a good deal with people in their free time, which would cut into our evenings or weekends. So that makes a big difference. Then when we adopted children, I quit work and I did volunteer stuff and go to evening meetings and things, and then I finally started teaching one night a week. And then we had a student live-in. That was one of the, I don't know if they do that anymore, but in those years, this was in the 50s, you could have a university student work for you, live in, give them board and room, and in return, they should do 20 hours of work for you, and maybe a couple nights babysitting, something like that. So this was a great asset. When our son was growing up, we did that. He was a baby, and Nancy, you see, was 4. And we had this, Ruth Doyle, Jim Doyle's wife, Ruth Doyle, got me started in this. We lived next door, and we were very good friends, and she had a girl there whose sister was ready to come to college and couldn't afford to live in a dormitory, and she needed to work her way and earn her room and board. And so Ginny came to us. Her sister Chris was next door working for the Doyles, and it was just a marvelous way to have really an additional member of the family, because everybody, you know, was together in that sense. It depended very much on the girl. Later, when she left after doing it for a couple of years, she went into a dorm.
we had a girl whose just personality just didn't click, and she stayed a year, but she just never was a real member of the family as Ginny was. So that was a great asset, having some help, of course, with small children. Then our kids, I remember feeling really guilty. The phone was all, Mama was always on the phone, and phone calls and meetings and, you know, trying to get off the phone so you can give your attention to your children when they're home from school or having other things, but kind of worked it out. I'm not sure to this day, however. I am sure that our son still would like it if Mother had not been gone to work. Now, I don't know whether he was harmed by it. I guess we all make those decisions.
Right. Well, now I know.
No.
What the consequences would have been if you'd stayed home all day.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's interesting because this was before so many women sensed that they needed to be out of the home in order to get their own personal growth
mm-hmm.
without busting up the marriage or, you know, harming the children and that sort of thing. But I guess that I really have a kind of a feeling that my life has just been sort of moving along. And it was very nice, this development happened, and then that one, and then that one, but I haven't had a real plan.
You never felt that you should stay home then, and just be?
Just at first, when they were young, really young. So I really did.
Did your husband actually help a lot around the house?
Yeah, not in the cooking. He's taken that up more lately, he certainly did help with the children and, you know, household chores and that sort of thing.
But you were still the manager?
Yeah, I'm very bossy, yes. As one of my friends said to me once, "Now, Virginia," she said, "you're not on the job, you're not working, don't tell us what to do." So I guess that, I was laughing with that about somebody the other day, one of my friends the other day, and she said, "Well, I never had the feeling you were telling us what to do, you know, when we all go to play tennis together or we all go to do these things together." But I've been kidded for years about being the executive type, you know, and sort of saying you should do this and do that and so forth, binding it up.
Your children feel this way too?
Oh, yes, I'm sure. I have to be really careful. I've learned as a grandmother now that I am one. I read two or three books before the baby was born. This little grandson is 2 1/2, and it said, "You must never tell them what to do or offer any suggestion until they ask you." And I've been trying to practice that from the very beginning. It's hard, too.
Did you, after the first experience when you tried to help your husband, did you share work after that at all, or did you all pretty much do your own?
Oh, we've helped each other a lot in different things. But I certainly have never,
in
the sense
with each
of being a research assistant or anything mm-hmm. like that, no, I have not done that. I think I've, you know, in being his partner and being with him in India or wherever we were, and just that we were together because we both enjoyed being together and doing things together, you know, only in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I could say that. So most of his professional friends know me too, just as many of my friends. Well, many of them do know Henry, and many of them don't, because he hasn't been that much visible. I remember in school for workers, he wasn't around there because I was teaching classes, and at night all these things were going on and so forth, and so sometimes they'd say to me, "What's your real name? What's your married name?" I said, "Hart. I'm using my name. That's it. What's your husband's name?" Then I'd tell him what he did and so forth. But there wasn't an occasion, and he was busily writing books, or he was writing his thesis, or he was doing his thing. And he wasn't having time to come and be around where I was doing my job and I was on duty. But I've always been very proud that I was married to a professor. I think that he and I both have this wonderful feeling about the university. We just admire and love the University of Wisconsin and feel that it's done. It's just a wonderful place to be. The things that it stood for and the changes that we've seen, you know, having been around for about 30, 40 years, a lot of changes.
And a lot more to come.
I suppose so, yeah. I suppose so.
We just want to talk a little bit about the protest movement and the effect on the department.
I guess that I don't feel qualified to talk about the effect on the department. I can think of various people and how we individuals responded, and the fact that everybody was terribly worried and concerned, and some could cope with this kind of tension and violence, you know, better than others. Bill Sewell was chancellor, I guess at that time, yes, campus chancellor. And it really got to him, this kind of violence and opposition. He's a very able man and a very wonderful person, but he just couldn't take that. Robin Fleming, on the other hand, came, you know, from the law school, and then after here he went over to be the president of the University of Michigan. He was able to cope with those people that came and sat down in his office and practically barricaded him, you know, in his office. He had a kind of, maybe it came from his labor conciliation and arbitration work, he had a cool head for kind of dealing with the hotheads and the violence that was going on. Maybe it separated a little bit faculty people who were so critical and so upset by it that they were not able to cope, from those who could kind of understand what was going on and empathize a bit but didn't want to see the violence. I guess that when I saw the movie that was made of the Dow Chemical thing, it came, Henry and I watched it last year. I guess we'd missed it earlier years when it was on. It was really quite shocking to see it again, because the actions of the police and the medicine, at least the force and the violence that was used, was horrible. We'd never tolerate that sort of thing anymore. I mean, medicine has grown, and that wouldn't happen now. That impressed me a lot, too. But I don't really feel I'm able to comment. One memory I do have is going to the Union Theater when there was a huge mass meeting, and I think that was when Bill Sewell was chancellor, and Paul Soglin was a leader among the students, and I can remember some of the bitterness and some of the talk between the students and the university authorities at that time, and many of us sitting in the audience wondering, where is it going next? You know, how is this issue ever going to be resolved?
Were you or your husband actively involved in the anti-war protest?
Not actively. And you see, we were back in India, 63 and 4, so we missed some of it. But we were here during the rest of it. No. Henry could probably comment on it more, because, of course, he was teaching right on the campus, and I wasn't right on the campus when this was going on. No, I guess I don't have anything more to say on that.
Okay.
I have an interesting comment that Ed Young made one time to me, and this was, I guess, after he was president.
What was president?
Yes,
mm-hmm.
President
or
of the university and our chancellor. And he was saying, you know, I have to thank you, Virginia, for getting me to serve on that Community Welfare Council back in about, it must have been 1968 or sometime like that, because you got me in a situation where I got to know the power of people in Madison. You know, these were the business people and the bankers and the presidents of the various companies. And he said that meant a lot to me at the university and to the university. And of course, he did function there. And I also got the fire chief at Durkin into that same activity because I wanted to be sure that we had union representation and somebody who cared about community activities. And Ed Durkin did. And he started back and then doing things, which he's always continued doing as a part of the Madison mm-hmm. community. But I was thinking about it in relation to Ed Young, who brought a lot to the community and to this understanding of dealing with how decisions are made and representing people who needed to get services, who weren't getting them, that type of thing. And then other university people who really have made an impact on this community in all kinds of other ways, you know, outside of the university life. Mm-hmm. That's been another very thrilling thing to see in Madison. I guess that's the end of my little anecdote.